Hello, this is Dr. Stephen Nurse, and this is my third and final series on the war in Vietnam, titled, A Letter is a Living Voice. We will be reading letters and documented accounts written by Vietnam veterans. These letters show all the emotion of war, from fear to anger to love and fellowship. These are only the opinions of the writers of the documents and not those of the voice of Vashon or the readers. In addition, while some of the language in the documents may appear to be racially insensitive, it is the actual language of war. It is my opinion that to use the exact language to give the listener a true understanding of the veterans' ratings and their associated emotions is extremely important. In war, we demonize our enemy through our language and our pictures. We make them inanimate, therefore easier to kill.
Wait a minute, wait a minute. Wait a minute, please make the postman wait. Wait a minute, wait a minute.
This is Dr. Nurse, and with me on this program, this episode is Rick Ames, who is engineering, and Susan Schreier, who is reading some of the letters and has donated some of her valuable Saturdays to read the letters. And also, she transcribed many of the letters and saved my eyesight on that because a lot of them were old microfiche articles. One of the things that I'd like to talk about a little bit, and as I've read tons of letters. Susan has read tons of letters, and Rick has listened to us talk about tons of letters. And I just got thinking this morning, Rick, has anything struck you about just in general about these letters that we've been reading and the articles and things we've been doing?
Well, to me, they're kind of scary, because I managed to dodge the draft, and with the specific intention of spending 4 years of my life in the Air Force rather than 2 years of my life in the Army, and didn't know that the Air Force also sent people over there and got in the way of difficulties, but they're kind of scary to me. And the one that actually appalled me was the guy talking about how the sergeant would go around and try to get people in trouble, try to court-martial people for petty offenses. I mean, it's bad enough you're in Vietnam, but now you got some lifer that's trying to make your life miserable on top of it. I mean, good heavens.
Yeah. And it's interesting, too. I think we come from different backgrounds in that. You know, I was going to school when all that was going on. I was in college. Like I said, you were in the Air Force. Susan, you had relatives, certainly.
I was a letter writer.
Yeah, you were a letter writer. Yeah, that's right. What has struck you about these letters just in general? I mean,
well, specifically the letter that we're reading today. It starts out when he's going into basic training, and then it continues to follow him through his experience in Vietnam, and just the change that you see with the young man over a short period of time.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things I think that has struck me is that, and we've talked about this a little bit before, but these young men, you know, these are young men that are 18, 19, 20, what the average age was about 19, had no idea what they were getting into. Just, you know, and even to be around death. I mean, you know, when I was 18, I think, you know, my grandmother died, and, you know, we had, you know, people from Iowa that we knew from way back that died, but never really experienced, certainly had never experienced anybody dying, you know, next to me. And I think that's really one of the difficult things. I have a friend that I went to high school with, kind of a really nice guy. His name was Gary. And He went to Vietnam, and he served in a medevac helicopter, and saw death every day. And his one of his jobs was to go out to sites where they had had battles and pick up people and parts of people. And he came back to Ellensburg. Eventually moved to Olympia, but just essentially was kind of a zombie. Yeah. I mean, he just wandered around. And now this guy that I knew, this big bulky guy, is just kind of a shadow of himself. Many, so, go ahead.
Many, if not most, I think 18-year-old young men feel kind of invincible. They feel like they're going to live forever. And I think this the war in Vietnam changed that.
Yeah.
Well, I was surprised at it, looking back on it and hearing some of the stuff we've been talking about, is the thousands and thousands of people involved. Clearly, they weren't all combat people, but it, nonetheless, and just being in Vietnam was enough of a trauma for people to really affect the rest of your life. And when you hear that they're sending 50,000 more, or the total number in that it served was, what was that?
About 57,000 that were killed there.
Were killed, yeah. But I mean, the number that it served was in the millions, as I recall.
Over many years.
Yeah, over the number of years, it was like 1.2 million or something. People that had been there and been through this meat grinder and sent back home with virtually no preparation for going back.
Yeah, and it says there were 2,709,918, I'm sure that's an exact number, Americans who served in uniform in Vietnam. We also, in the 58,148 men and women who were killed in Vietnam.
Yeah.
But we don't think about, we don't think about also there were, as there are in other wars, many civilians that were in the country that mm-hmm. were providing services and doing that kind of thing. So I think that that's really pretty crucial. And what I get from these letters, too, is almost kind of them always asking, what's going on here? What am I doing here? Why are we climbing a mountain and capturing a mountain and then climbing down the next day, things like that. One of the series we're also going to be doing, or a series of letters, is from a gentleman named Paul O'Connell, and I'm trying to get a hold of him and interview him, too, because he's written 80 letters, one for every day that he was, 80 letters, and almost every day he was there because he couldn't write every day. Susan is going to start reading a letter today. And these are some letters, actually. And these are from a gentleman who lives on the island. And I actually talked to him on the telephone yesterday. His name is Chris Gaynor, a very strong advocate for vets, and also has an amazing photographic exhibit at the Heritage Museum here in town. So, Susan, do you want to go ahead and...
Sure. These letters take place between June of 1966 and September of 1967, and they're from PFC Christopher B. Gaynor, and the first one is from Riley, Kansas. And these letters are all to Anne. Dear Anne, your letter was the first I've received and certainly the most appreciated. It cheered me considerably at a time when I really needed to be cheered. I've been in this army for 7 weeks, but it seems more like a lifetime. I find myself doing things unconsciously, which only a short time ago would have seemed inconceivable. From complete freedom to none, and it's given me much food for thought. We just completed our 2 weeks of training in the field. Some of the things we had to do were as close to hell as I've come in a long time. We lived similarly to field mice, and we bathed from canteens. Despite the hardships, I love this experience as well as almost anything I've ever done. Our encampment was on an open field with trees and green fields as far as the horizon. The country being so flat here makes the sky appear unlimited, and in Kansas, it's always deep blue. I find it quite breathtaking, perhaps because all of my life, scenes similar to this have been broken up by artificial obstacles. The general attitude of my comrades and myself is that what we are learning right now is more important for practical reasons than it used to be. 90% of the training consists of showing us how to keep alive. I'm fairly sure at this time that I will be a combat medic. If this happens, it will relieve me of having to tear my mind apart to reach a conclusion about what my actions should be when asked to kill. As a medic, I won't be killing anyone, and I'll have the chance to save a few. From the small bits of news I get about Vietnam, I really feel the only honorable place to be is beneath a saffron robe. I often am hit by the realization that quite possibly as many as a quarter of the men I'm training with right now will be either dead or shot up by this time next year. The most horrible thought is that they will have died for the wrong reasons. Is the army softening my head, or is this Spain reincarnated? I've made friends from all parts of the U.S. I have a friend from New Jersey who tells me about New York City. The more I talk about things as they are in the East, I realize that I would probably like this country a lot more if I hadn't lived in Southern California all of my life. Have you heard from Mark? I hope he's feeding his soul with life before he gets caught as I have. I could choose a brother. It would be Mike, and Aaron is my choice for a kid sister to be cherished. You, Anne, are forever the queen of my thoughts. You seem to understand who I am, and I know you will understand whatever I've managed to communicate in this letter. Love, Chris.
Wow. Yeah. And just to bring a little more light to that, and I know Chris wouldn't mind me saying this because he has talked about it. Chris is gay and has lived with his partner Paul now for many, many years. And that was something that he had to deal with that I'm sure others did too. But going into the military in 19, you know, in those years, 68 and
66,
yeah. That was a year that I graduated. And I mean, it was, you know, it was not politically correct to be gay at that time. I mean, I don't know how exactly to say it, but you know, we are much, much more open society now. We, at least we try to be a much more open society. But so he was in the military. He was a warrior. He was a fighter. He was infantry. And yet he had to deal with this and a country that didn't support him in that way. So I think that's just important to mention. So let's go on with the next one.
This next letter, I'm guessing he continued his training in Fort Ord, California, and this one is dated August 1st, 1966. Cher Anna, I find myself going to school again. It's not bad. Of all things, I have an aptitude for Morse code. After 9 days of exposure, I'm copying 10 words a minute and shall be sending as many by next week. The course offers, in addition to code, all manners of radio communications. When I finish, I'll be able to read maps and have a working knowledge of the intricacies of pinpointing myself and others on a topographic map, and subsequently breaking the position down into grid coordinates and sending them either by code or by voice. This will be one of my primary functions with the artillery unit to which I'm assigned. I will also have to operate and maintain most of the radios the Army uses. We even spent a week learning to drive the new Army jeeps and small trucks with which we will be carrying our equipment. Sorry to drag you through all that, but that's what I'm doing, and I've become rather interested in it. After all, under no other circumstances would I have the opportunity or incentive to learn such things. I went to San Francisco yesterday. I spent most of the day riding the trolley. However, when I first got off the bus upon arriving in the city, I found myself wandering in the direction of the Civic Center. There's something about the city which excites me tremendously. Particularly in that part of the city, there's a feeling of spaciousness and grandeur which Los Angeles just doesn't contain. While I was taking in all this, I had gone far enough to enter the park in front of the city hall. I was in the middle of an anti-war convention of some sort. It wasn't a demonstration, really. Tables had been set up, and just about every unpopular movement was represented. I was in my dress greens, looking very soldierly and out of place. I don't know who felt more awkward, me or them. I wanted to say something, but I was struck dumb. I stood a moment, and then I just walked away. It was one of those moments of inadequacy which will always haunt me. I don't even know how I feel about Vietnam anymore. I'm constantly being told stories about what it's like by men who've been there. The stories present such an inconsistent picture that it would be impossible to make a stand on any of them. The one feature which does seem to hold true, no matter who you ask, is that the American soldiers are suffering and struggling for something that they just can't define, but seems to all feel. I got my pictures back from the day I had my camera over there. They came out really well. I'll be coming down a weekend soon, and I'll bring them to you. I've had quite a bit of practice time, but I'm having trouble finding a place to practice. The barracks is out of the question. There's too many radios and related commotion. I may find a solution in the service club. Is Erin still studying code? If she is, when I come down, we'll have to exchange a few messages. Mike's guitar must be almost completed by now. I hope I get a chance to see it. I've read The Shoes of the Fisherman and shall send it along as soon as possible. Somewhere this novel is a letdown, particularly when I think how excellent The Advocate was. He just doesn't do anything with the most important ideas. Kirill is the character who makes the whole thing well worth reading, however. My peculiar mood at the time of reading may have had something to do with my negative reactions to other parts. I look forward to one thing. It overshadows my whole life at this point. I want out of the army and will count the days until I finish my hitch. Perhaps soon I can see you. Love, Chris.
Wow. You know, another interesting thing is that I think the veterans got so many different messages. You know, in the interviews that we've done, you know, we found some that went back to their local communities and were supported, didn't feel that they were being mistreated in any way. Others felt exactly the opposite, in that when the minute they got off the plane, they were being spat on. They were being hurled insults at. And they were told not to wear. Several of the folks that we interviewed talked about. They were instructed not to wear their army uniforms when they were home. And I think that one of the quotes that I found that I think is really kind of important here is, it says, "The war in Vietnam was not like World War II. In World War II, the Americans were the heroes who saved Europe from Nazi tyranny and Hitler. They came back to America to open arms." And I mean, I think we can all remember those, you know, those ticker tape parades in New York and all those things. "The soldiers who returned from Vietnam were told to keep a low profile, to not wear their uniforms in public. And if they did, they were spat upon, cursed, and called baby killers." And, boy, what conundrum to serve your life, or, you know, to serve for the country, to put your life at pretty severe risk. I mean, there were 23,214 men who became 100% disabled as a result of the war. There were 5,283 who lost limbs and 1,081 who lost multiple limbs. When you think about the families that had to deal with those things, I mean, I had a friend that just in the last month has lost two limbs at the knee as a result of circulation. And it's just a life changer. Chris is pretty articulate, I think.
Very.
In his feelings, yeah.
And you'll go on to hear one of the things they talk about back and forth, Anna and Chris, is books that they're reading.
Yeah. So that's cool. Let's go ahead. And
So this next letter is from back in Fort Riley, Kansas. His training has taken him to a lot of places, and I'm guessing that his first hope to be a medic never did happen.
No, never did.
Yeah. Share, Anna. I've been reading Man. How strange it seems to read of such divine things and have to live under such raw conditions. It sets my own feelings afar from this mode of living. I hardly know whether I will prevail or the army will make a victim of my ideals. I hate the organization, and yet I am on such intimate terms with its working. I move easily within its structure. I've experienced Kansas cold, or I should say a foretaste of such. 5 days in the field turned out to be 5 days of frozen ears and toes. During my first training, I was amused by the camp-out spirit, but this was too much like the real thing. The artillery pieces blasted away night and day, and there was much tossing of gas bombs into our camp in the small hours of the morning. I'm a radio operator without a radio. Such is the state of affairs in this unit. We have lots of field wire and many small radios, but not any of the equipment that I've been trained on. The battery thinks I'm an ammo bearer. The COMO chief has me as a teletype operator, and the communications operator is getting me a secret clearance so that I can handle crypto material. But mostly, I just dust the shelves. I mentioned to you once that I had seen such radical tension in the Army. It remains true, as far as I've seen. However, I've become more aware of individual comments and feelings among the people I work with. I fail to understand how so many men can have a Negro friend whom they pal around with every day by choice, and then among an all-white group make incredibly thoughtless remarks about, in quotes, them niggers. If what I think is the case, and that being they don't see any relationship between the individual and the rest of the maligned race, must they then feel the necessity to make such all-encompassing remarks? The occurrences are not loud, but rather as confidential insights for the imparting of which I've many times been drawn aside. These are always accompanied by a quick perusal of the room. This phenomenon remains a mystery to me. This is such a drab place. I've taken to drinking great quantities of beer. There is only one town nearby, Junction City. No need to spend any time there, as it is everything nauseous about the Midwest. Kansas is a dry state, so it isn't even possible to sit on a bar stool with a glass of scotch. I play my guitar, which has turned out to be a really good instrument when the mood takes me, and I read. In all fairness, I must admit the turning of the leaves in autumn air is very becoming and pleasant, and I'm looking forward to the first snow. I hope that Jimmy will fight his right direction on the induction issue, and I'm even more hopeful that he will be spared any confrontation whatever with these people. I would guess that Mark is getting closer to this very confrontation. Mike can certainly continue to develop artistically for several years without much worry. I send my love to Aaron. Con Dios, Chris.
And, you know, Chris did become quite a classical guitar player after he got out. He was in England for a while and studied under some pretty amazing classic guitar players in Europe. I also think we need to comment on, you know, he uses the term Negro for African Americans. But and even when I say that, that was at that time, in certainly in the 50s and, you know, in the early 60s, the proper term that everybody used was Negro. I mean, and then it became, you know, it's changed and it's morphed to different things. And, you know, now we refer to it as the, you know, sometimes we always talk about the N word, which was certainly very, very demeaning. But
and very difficult to read.
Right, right. And, interesting too, in, you know, we look at who was Mark Twain in what is it where they use the term with Joe, the friend of not Tom Sawyer, but
Huckleberry Finn.
Yeah, Huckleberry Finn. You know,
Black Joe.
Yeah, and it's interesting. We talk about how much do we sanitize old, you know, classical books like that? I taught those to my kids in several classes, and we read the actual words. What I did was I explained to them, you know, kind of the history of it. And I think I don't think we should sanitize all of our things. Okay, let's go on with another one here.
This next one is from Vietnam. It's from an APO address in San Francisco, postmarked February 2nd, 1967. Anna, we sighted land early this evening, the wet, hot greenness of Vietnam, breaking the monotony of the ocean, which I have lived with for 3 interminable weeks. We are creeping carefully down the coast to make our debarkment point tomorrow morning. I think I hear heavy artillery, but perhaps I'm imagining it. It looks too lonely and peaceful for the ugliness of howitzers. We stopped in Okinawa for a day last week. My excitement was unbounded at the experience of that first breath of the Orient, that mingled fragrance mixed of the living vegetation, dung of the fields, the sweat of small unique egos. I had heard of the phenomenon, but the effect of the perfume is an atmosphere beyond description. I went ashore and traveled by bus for the width of the island, drinking in the fantastic beauty of the countryside. We were supposed to stay on the military base, but I escaped and wandered the whole day in the city of Naha, not unlike Mazatlan in its buildings and general atmosphere, yet marvelously new to me in its detail. I found a marketplace that could only exist in one's imagination, a square mile of narrow streets through which no automobiles pass, each stall exhibiting exotic fruits or displays of meat, fish, or vegetables to delight the eye and the nose. I found myself walking through what would be considered the poor sector, but was as clean and well cared for as the rest of the city. My mere presence caused much giggling and excitement among the children, who were quick to return my smiles. It's darkening now, and the officer of the watch is signaling our escort ship with his lamp. A squadron of jets has just passed very close over us, headed for the mainland, for what task I don't want to think of. The air is so rich, I feel I could swim through it. There are only a few lights visible on the coast, and I still hear the repeated boom of not too distant guns. Tomorrow we land, and we meet what is waiting for us. I think I feel fear in myself and see it in others. I pray you are all well. Love, Chris.
Wow. Yeah, I think that it's I also find it interesting the difference between, you know, what he talks about is the horror of war, and yet I hear so many people also talking about the beauty of this, you know, the beauty of this country. So, yeah, comment?
No, there's just one letter left.
Oh, okay. Why don't we go ahead and finish that? Let's go ahead and finish that.
Okay, this one is postmarked September 15th, 1967. 22nd Infantry Division, APO, San Francisco. Anna, dear, I don't know where to begin after so many months. However, I've begun, haven't I, in this wretched green ink. Some things have definitely happened since I last wrote. I've been put into a different unit, and I spent a couple of strenuous months since learning the rules of this nasty little war firsthand. It's not so simple, Anna. For each person, there is a totally different viewpoint. Each day shows a different side. God, if I only knew what the answer is. I just want to be quit of it. The details are ugly. I hope I can talk to you sometime about it and put it all on the line for inspection and introspection. These Vietnamese are the most unwarlike people imaginable, and yet from years of war, they've learned to take events of violence as calmly as their morning tea. I've known some really beautiful girls, and it tears my heart out to realize deep down, they probably hate me, and justifiably, I'm the foreign invader. I've been reading Molière. He gives me a great uplift. My mother got me a whole stack of his plays in paperback. It's quite true that all comedy after him is merely slightly different treatment of his comic invention. I've also got some man. I think you know that he is among my favorite all time. What of all my friends? Norman, the Z's, Bernie. This is so short. I promise to write again soon. I miss you terribly, Anna. Love, Chris.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you very much. And we're going to cut our session at that point. And we will see you at the next episode. Thank you.
Listening to Is Abled with Dr. Stephen Nurse. This has been part three of his series on the war in Vietnam entitled A Letter is a Living Voice. To hear additional episodes, including his previous series on the Vietnam War, go to voiceofashon.org and look for Is Abled under the Shows tab.